ever laugh at puppy love or shrug it off. My kids are going through their first wild crushes, and I know how they can hurt. Anyway, Dee Dee was away most of the time at the store. Ed paid little attention to us, and Daddy spent most of his spare time with Freddie. Maybe I was still searching for a father. Maybe Johnny reminded me of another Mediterranean type I had once been crazy about, my Uncle George. Whatever the reason, the summer I was almost 15, I fell deeply in love with an Italian boy of 23. Johnny DeVita had a John Garfield build, but his features were finely chiseled and his dark eyes warm and full of life. He came from a large, prosperous Jamestown family and was studying to be a doctor when I first met him. At first, my nutty antics made him laugh. Then we danced together at the ballroom. He was very sweet and protective toward me. Mainly, we talked. I wanted to share with him everything that had ever happened to me and all my hopes for the future. I had no thought of being an actress then. I just wanted to be somebody and to make things easier for Dee Dee. When my friend Pauline Lopez and I went back to the Little Red Schoolhouse in Celeron in the fall of 1926 as high school freshmen, we were the only girls in the school with boyish bobs. This inspired us to put on our first amateur production, Charlie's Aunt. I had a wonderful teacher that year, Miss Lillian Appleby, who, like Mr. Drake, tried to channel my driving urge to express myself into acting. Dee Dee never tried to hem me in. Be an actress? Sure, why not? She sat up until midnight many nights, sewing her eyes out, making us costumes, and was in charge of many school productions. Dee Dee didn't turn a hair when we hauled to the school stage all the brown wicker living room furniture she was still buying on time. When my stepfather got home from work, he raised Cain. "There's no place to sit," he protested. Dee Dee shrugged. "We'll sit on the front porch in the swing till the play is over," she told him. For the most part, Ed encouraged my acting. But I don't think a stage career ever occurred to me until one night when he took me to see the great monologist Julius Tannen in the Celeron School Auditorium. This virtuoso sat in a chair on a bare stage with a single light over his head and transported us wondrously. Recently, I had a chance to meet Mr. Tannen and tell him what an important part he played in my getting into the business. With Charlie's Aunt, I knew for the first time that wonderful feeling that comes from getting real laughs on a stage. I not only played the male lead, but sold the tickets, swept up the stage afterwards, and turned out the lights. The night of the first performance, Pauline stood at the entrance to the school auditorium collecting tickets. She barely had time to dash backstage and throw on her long Victorian skirts and her bonnet before I yanked the curtain up. She started to speak her opening lines, then stopped, and a funny expression came over her face. "What's the matter?" I hissed. "Forget your lines?" "No," said Pauline with great annoyance. "I forgot my makeup." This was the main reason she wanted to be in the play, the chance to use real makeup with her mother's approval. Charlie's Aunt was a great success. We charged 25 cents a ticket and made $25 and gave all of it to the ninth grade for a class party. Pauline and I often recall the thrill that gave us. She still lives in the same little house in Celeron and is now a dedicated guidance counselor who never stops learning and giving. The success of Charlie's Aunt encouraged me to get into as many musical and dramatic offerings as I could, from the school drama club to the Shriners annual productions. I even bounced up on the stage of the Palace Theater in Jamestown to be photographed by some traveling shyster who had fallen heir to an old camera and some bad film. That was my first moving picture, something called Tilly the Toiler. When I was 15, the Harry F. Miller Company put on a musical called The Scottish Rite Review on that same palace stage. I did an Apache dance with such fervor that I fell into the orchestra pit and pulled an arm out of its socket. The Jamestown Post-Journal hailed me as a new discovery, and the head of the Jamestown Players, Bill Bemis, told me I was chock-full of talent. That summer, I worked at the park at an ice cream stand and danced through the starry summer nights with Johnny. Dee Dee disapproved of my romance with him. She felt he was too old for me, and She was troubled by rumors surrounding Johnny's father and the mob. This was the lawless 20s, the era of the untouchables, Al Capone, and Prohibition. Technically, everyone who touched alcohol was a lawbreaker, the guy who ran the booze in from Canada and the guy who bought it from him illegally. I thought Prohibition was a silly and impractical law, and so did most people at the time, even Dee Dee. But my mother didn't want me involved with anyone who might be deemed unsavory. Prohibition had a bad effect on Celeron. For with the closing of all public bars, the great resort hotels ringing the lake began to die on their feet. Some were boarded up, others torn down. When the fine restaurants and hotels disappeared, the wealthy oil families from Pittsburgh began to go elsewhere, and their big houses stood empty. Beautiful Celeron Amusement Park began to go slightly downhill. It was never a Coney Island. There were no barkers or cheap sideshows, but gradually, the type of people strolling through the park and doing business there changed. I was much too busy working to pay much attention. I had a few brushes with disaster. I had to run like hell to get out of the way of somebody rolling out of a speakeasy, but just once or twice. Early one morning, Johnny wasn't as lucky. His father was shot and killed in front of the Catholic Church as he came out of 6 o'clock Mass. Johnny's ambition to be a doctor died with his father. From then on, he was head of his family, with a mother and many siblings to support. Dee Dee asked Johnny to stay away from me. It didn't do much good, although in my heart I must have known she was right. Eventually, given her opposition and Johnny's new responsibilities, he and I saw less and less of each other. But our love was the real thing. It remained a love that haunted me for many years, at least until I came to Hollywood. The summer following my sophomore year at high school, they held a Miss Celeron bathing beauty contest at the park. Miss America of 1927 was to be the judge, and it was quite a big deal locally. I didn't particularly want to be in a bathing beauty contest. I was very skinny, being my present height of 5'7½", but weighing less than 100 pounds. And I had freckles on my back, which embarrassed me terribly. But somebody entered my name, so I went along with it. The feminine ideal at this time was Clara Bow, with her heart-shaped face and short ringlets. I tried my darndest to look like Clara Bow, but to no avail. The candidates were supposed to have their pictures in the paper before the contest, and Dee Dee sent me to the best photographer in Jamestown, T. Henry Black. It was Mr. Black who was quoted as saying, "It's very difficult to get a satisfactory picture of Miss Ball because the lady is just not photogenic." I think I was runner-up in the contest, but what I remember most is my embarrassment. Only recently have I begun wearing bathing suits again. Right after the beauty contest came the 4th of July, the real start of my 16th summer and the biggest weekend at the amusement park. My grandfather Fred, in a holiday mood, came home from work on the trolley with a mysterious object wrapped in brown paper. It was a birthday present for Freddie, who was about to turn 12. A real 22 caliber rifle. Freddie wanted to shoot crows right away, but Daddy told him, "You can't use it until tomorrow, Fritzy boy. Tomorrow, I'll show you how." Early the next morning, the crowds began piling off the trolley and heading toward the lake, with picnic baskets and the small fry waving little red, white, and blue flags. It was a bright, sunny July day, and the heavy scent of clover floated from the meadow which stretched between us and the railroad tracks. I was in a hurry to get to my hamburger job at the park, but I hung around for a little while to watch the gun lesson. Although Cleo and Freddie were big kids now, I still thought of them as my charges. Daddy set up a tin can target in our backyard and then, in his usual, meticulous, careful way, explained all about the gun. Besides me and Freddie, there were Cleo and Joanna, a girl Freddie's age who was visiting someone in the neighborhood. Daddy placed the tin can about 40 feet away in the direction of some open fields where there were no houses. There was an 8-year-old boy who lived at the corner whose name was Warner Erickson. Every once in a while you would hear his mother shriek, "Warner! Get home!" And Warner would streak for his yard since his mother spanked him for the slightest infraction. This 4th of July weekend he had wandered into our yard and was peeking around the corner of our house watching the target practice. We didn't notice him at first, but then Daddy told him, "Now, Warner, please sit down and stay out of the way." Warner moved close to us and obediently sat down on the grass to watch. My friend Pauline was also watching from a safe distance on her back stoop. My brother was shooting at the target, and then it was his little girlfriend's turn. Joanna picked up the gun and held it against her shoulder with one eye closed. At that moment, we heard a strident, "Warner! Get home this minute!" Warner darted in the direction of his home, right in front of the rifle. The gun went off and Warner fell spread-eagled to the ground, into the lilac bushes. "I'm shot! I'm shot!" Warner screamed. "No, you're not," said Daddy. "Get up!" Then we saw the spreading red stain on Warner's shirt, right in the middle of his back. Cleo screamed, and I took her in my arms. Warner was exactly her age and was her special playmate. The slam of a screen door told me that Pauline was running to tell her mother. Daddy looked stunned. Then he picked up Warner, as gently as a leaf. He talked to him in a low, comforting voice. The girl who had fired the gun was in shock. The balloon ascension was beginning at the park. You could see it drifting above the trees to the burst of applause below. Warner was quiet in Daddy's arms, and we all walked the 100 yards to his house. Then Warner's mother burst out of her back door. At the sight of the blood and her son's slack body, she began screaming hysterically. There was a long, long wait for the ambulance. While we huddled together in a frightened group, Mrs. Erickson raced up and down the street, telling everyone, "They've shot my son! They've shot my son!" The next few days were a kind of nightmare as we all hung onto bulletins from the hospital. Then we learned the awful news. A .22 caliber bullet is very small, but by fantastic bad luck, the bullet passed right through Warner's spine, severing the cord. One of my first scrapbooks contains a yellowed clipping from the Post Journal of July 5, 1927. Warner Erickson, 8 years old, of Celeron, is still in critical condition at Jamestown General Hospital as a result of being shot in the back Sunday, July 3rd, at Celeron. Lucille and Fred Ball were shooting at a target at the rear of their home. The Erickson lad stepped out in the range as Joanna Ottinger, a young girl, fired at about the same time, the bullet entering the boy's back and passing through his lungs, lodging in the chest. Mr. Hunt, grandfather of the Ball children, was watching the target practice. In a week or so, Warner came home from the hospital. His mother often wheeled him up and down the sidewalk in front of our house. Each time Cleo saw him, she started to cry. We were all terribly fond of Warner. Daddy would have gladly paid Warner's doctor's bills for the rest of his life, but the Erickson's didn't come to see Daddy. They went to a lawyer. They planned to sue Daddy for everything he had. They told the whole neighborhood. Feelings ran hot and high, pro and con. Daddy couldn't believe anyone could even think it was anything but an accident. The possibility of a lawsuit worried him greatly. He was then 62 and near the end of his working career. His tiny life savings and the house were all he had to face the future. So, on the advice of a lawyer, he deeded the house over to his daughters, Dee Dee and Lola, for payment of $1. It was almost a year before the case came to trial in the county civil court. Daddy was charged with negligence, since he had been the only adult present. It was a muggy, overcast day in May 1928, the lilacs in full heady bloom, when Daddy's lawyer drove us to the imposing yellow courthouse in Mayville at the northern end of the lake. The colonial-style courtroom was large and imposing, with light wood paneling and impressive oil portraits around the room of judges in their somber robes. The Erickson's wheeled in young Warner and parked him right in front of the jury box so that everybody could get a good look at him. Two Jamestown doctors who had attended him testified how the bullet had entered his spine. Warner was paralyzed from the waist down for life, they said. He sat listening with bright, intelligent eyes. I was trembling and feeling sick to my stomach. Daddy was white as a sheet. My grandfather didn't have many witnesses in his defense. Just Dee Dee, Freddie, Cleo, and me. The visiting girl who fired the shot, Joanna Ottinger, wasn't there. Her testimony might have helped Daddy a great deal, but she was home in another state. In fact, none of us ever saw her again. Cleo cried on the witness stand, and Freddie and I, scared half to death, stuttered and stammered as we stated and restated all the precautions Daddy had taken. How Warner, uninvited, had been told to sit on the grass at a safe distance and not to move, and how he had suddenly popped up at the sound of his mother's voice and darted in front of the gun. The trial began one afternoon and continued into the next morning. Someone got on the witness stand and said that Daddy had made a target out of Warner and let us practice on him. We couldn't believe our ears. How could anyone possibly blame Daddy for the accident? It was just an inexplicable tragedy. The jury went out at about 11 o'clock in the morning and was gone for 4.5 hours. We paced up and down the courthouse corridors for what seemed an eternity. Then the jury solemnly filed back, and we learned that the Ericksons had won their case. Daddy had been negligent, they said, and he must pay the Ericksons $4,000. Although all the gold in the world couldn't restore Warner's ability to walk. Now, this doesn't seem like a great deal of money today, but in 1928, it was everything we had. Daddy claimed the house wasn't his, it belonged to his daughters, but he handed over all his savings and insurance, every cent he had accumulated in a lifetime of hard work, and declared bankruptcy. The Ericksons were not satisfied. They sued Daddy again, claiming that Daddy's deeding of the house to his daughters for a dollar was fraudulent, designed to delay and defraud his creditors. Again, the Ericksons won, and again the sheriff appeared, this time to foreclose on the house and to arrest Daddy and take him off to jail. This whole affair gave me the most distorted view of justice and so-called due process. To my mind, Daddy was blameless. The judge must have thought so, too, because he released Daddy from jail almost immediately, but said that he must remain within the city limits of Mayville for a year. Mayville was about 20 miles from Celeron, so Dee Dee had to board him out with some farm relatives for the year. But Daddy's ruin was still incomplete. In September 1928, our beloved little house in Celeron was put on the auction block. Curiosity seekers came tramping over Daddy's vegetable garden and poking into the chicken coop and charging up and down the stairs and opening closet doors. To me, it was the final straw. The most unjust, inhumane thing I had ever heard of. I just couldn't understand it all. The house was worth $4,000, but only brought $2,600 at auction. All of this was swallowed up by the mortgage Daddy still owed and various legal fees, so the Ericksons got nothing. They took our house, the furnishings that Dee Dee had bought so laboriously on time, week after week, the insurance, everything. It was god-awful, unbelievable. My grandfather never worked again. The heart went out of him. I don't see how anyone can reconcile the punishment with the crime in this case. It made me suspicious of the law forever, and a fear of guns has stayed with me to this day. It ruined Celeron for us. It destroyed our life together there. We moved away to a little apartment on Wilcox Avenue in Jamestown. I entered my junior year in a new, strange high school, which I hated. Shortly after this, I began running away. I'd take off to Chicago, Cleveland, Buffalo, anywhere. I bought my first dog, a little fox terrier, named him Whoopi. Wherever I went, Whoopi went too. But sometimes my driving was too much for him. Once I hit 80 miles an hour in one of the local dirt roads, and Whoopi jumped right out of the car and broke a leg. I itched to go places and do things. Dee Dee was beside herself with worry about me. She finally decided that if I was bound to run away, it would be better if she helped and guided me. So one night at dinner in our little Wilcox Avenue apartment, she said to me, "Lucille, how would you like to go to dramatic school?" My eyes popped. Could we afford it? "I've already been to the bank, and they'll lend me the money," Dee Dee told me. My mother was always willing to go into hock for a good cause. 3. Actors and actresses all strive for affection. We get up on a stage because we want to be loved. The stage fulfills this need better than anything else. Especially if you found a rapport with an audience and can wrap them up in your arms and hug them close. The irony is that, in our terrible need to be loved, we pick an arena where we can also be rejected by the greatest possible number of people. Nothing's quite so wonderful as those waves of love and applause splashing over the footlights, and nothing quite as shattering as when an audience doesn't like you. All you've got to sell is yourself. Rejection can't be anything but highly personal. I didn't begin to have what it takes to succeed in show business when I first came to New York City as an upstate country kid of 17. Dee Dee and I chose the John Murray Anderson Robert Milton Theater School in New York mainly because the tuition was a bit cheaper than in other dramatic schools. To save more money, I lived with some elderly friends of the family on Dyckman Street in Upper Manhattan. The day I left, Johnny drove me to Buffalo, some 70 miles from home. From there, I took the New York Central South. New York City scared me to death, and still does. It has something to do with all that cold concrete and steel instead of grass and trees. I was terrified and struck dumb by everyone at the dramatic school. Robert Milton, one of the heads of the school, was my elocution teacher. The very first day, he asked me to pronounce horses and water. The class giggled as I complied, and Mr. Milton struck his brow. An exaggerated horror. How Midwestern, he remarked. We'll have to change that. I could tell right off he wasn't too fond of me. In short order, they discovered that I couldn't sing, I couldn't dance, I couldn't control my body or my voice properly. Both students and teachers ignored me, which almost seemed fitting. To me, everyone was head and shoulders above me in every way. Another student at the school earned raves for everything she did. A short, dynamic blonde, she projected with great verve. Betty Davis went on to confirm the school's belief in her awe-inspiring abilities. At the end of the term, the school wrote my mother and said that they were sorry, but I didn't have what it takes to be an actress. She would be wasting her money if I continued. Of the 70 students who began that term, only 12 made it. I was one of the failures. Although lonely, homesick, and lost, I couldn't face the sneers and snickers I felt would be waiting for me back in Jamestown. This was the day of the Ziegfeld Follies and Schubert spectacles. Hundreds of girls were hired to decorate the stage in fur and feathers, so I decided to become a showgirl. I soon learned that to survive in the theater, you have to be very strong, very healthy, and damn resilient. Rarely does anyone give you an encouraging word, and I dreaded that inevitable question. Do you have any Broadway experience? I'd stick out my thin chest and say brightly, No, sir, I haven't done anything on Broadway, but I'd sure like to try. I'd then add that I'd come all the way from Butte, Montana. This eager and slightly dishonest little speech won me 5 jobs in various musicals, such as Rear Line Chorus Girl in the 3rd Road Company of Rio Rita. No one got paid for rehearsals in those days, so Dee Dee dug deep to keep me afloat. One morning, I woke up to find that all I had was 4 pennies. Subway fare to the theater district was a nickel, so I panhandled for a penny. One well-dressed older man stopped to listen, then offered me a $10 bill. Listen, mister, I told him with a withering look, all I want is 1 penny. He's probably still standing there with his mouth open. The seductive Schubert girls were mean old harpies. They hated all competition, especially 17-year-old kids. I'd show up early for rehearsals and stay until they had to sweep me off the stage with the cigar butts, but I couldn't seem to get the hang of things, even if all I had to do was walk. I was supposed to project sultry sex, but all I managed to get across was my awkward timidity. I was so shy that all I could do was shrink in a corner and watch and listen. If someone asked me a question, words stuck in my throat. Time after time, I'd rehearse for several weeks and then get fired. I was never around long enough for the first costume fitting. I don't blame the directors. I'd have fired that cringing scaredy cat Lucille Ball, too. But I didn't give up. I wore out my soles trudging to casting offices and stuffed the holes with newspaper. I lurked behind coffee bars waiting for customers to leave. In 1928, you got 2 donuts and a cup of coffee for a dime. Often a customer might leave 1 donut uneaten and a nickel tip. I'd wiggle into his seat fast, devour the leftover donut, and order coffee with the tip. Then I was picked for the chorus of a Fred and Paula Stone show. It was stepping stones. When 5 weeks had passed and I was still with the show, my spirits skyrocketed. Then, late one night, the producer called for some revisions in the dance numbers. Around midnight, the director finally said, "We're going to add some ballet, girls. Anybody who can't do toe work is out of the show." To me, he added, "Forget it, Two Gun. You're a nice kid, but you just don't have it. Why don't you go home to Montana and raise a big family?" I dug my hands into my empty pockets and trudged the long blocks north to my Fleabag apartment in a Columbus Circle rooming house. I can't say that I was discouraged. For some incomprehensible reason, I knew that someday I'd make it as an actress. I just decided to postpone the struggle for a while. I didn't want to be a drag on Dee Dee any longer. Here's what I advise any young, struggling actress today. The important thing is to develop as a woman first, and a performer second. You wouldn't prostitute yourself to get a part, not if you're in your right mind. You won't be happy whatever you do unless you're comfortable with your own conscience. Keep your head up. Keep your shoulders back. Keep your self-respect. Be nice. Be smart. And remember, there are practically no overnight successes. Before that brilliant hit performance came 10, 15, sometimes 20 years in the salt mines, sweating it out. I cured myself of my shyness when it finally occurred to me that people didn't think about me nearly as much as I gave them credit for. The truth was, nobody really gave a damn. Like most teenagers, I was much too self-centered. When I stopped being prisoner to what I worried was others' opinions of me, I became more confident and free. But I still needed to eat. It was midnight on a Saturday when I was fired from Stepping Stones after 5 weeks of rehearsal with no pay. Sunday, I leafed through the classified ads, and early Monday morning I landed a $25-a-week job modeling coats. A steady diet of coffee and donuts hadn't added much flesh to my figure, so I decided winter coats would hide my skinniness. My fellow models were a helpful bunch. They got me blind dates for dinner and taught me how to stretch that dinner into two. I watched in admiration as a red-headed model gave me my first lesson. With a wink at me, while the waiter wasn't watching, she first put a linen table napkin into her handbag, then several buttered rolls, celery, and olives, and a big slice of roast beef. Sometimes, if you brought a big enough handbag, you could squeeze in a little French pastry, too. My first modeling job was a good one, in a small wholesale coat place on 7th Avenue run by some nice elderly Jewish people. Then I worked at a dress and suit house where I told them my name was Diane Belmont. I'd always liked the name Diane. Belmont Racetrack on Long Island inspired the last name. Some of my old friends on 7th Avenue still call me Diane. They think Hollywood changed my name to Lucille Ball. All the time I was in New York, I was sick with longing for my family. When I couldn't stand it any longer, I'd pack up and go home for a while. Back home, I worked as a clerk in a dress shop and as a Walgreens soda jerk across from Jamestown Hotel. Daddy was still staying with relatives in Mayville, and once in a while we'd borrow a car and take him out for a drive. I remember how we'd panic if we accidentally drove outside the Mayville city limits, since he was still prohibited from leaving. Daddy was in a highly depressed state of mind, and I worried about him constantly. One day, toward the end of his year's sentence, I heard that our farm relatives picked strawberries and that that was all they were giving Daddy to eat. Just strawberries, three times a day. My good friend Marion Strong remembers that I was so upset and so furious, I threw a tantrum unlike any before. I threw plates and pillows, stomped my feet, roared, then wept. She was afraid I'd lost my sanity. "I'll make it up to Daddy someday," I vowed loudly. "I'll show him, you'll see." How I was going to do this, I had no idea. But I knew I couldn't do it as a soda jerk in Jamestown. So back to New York I went, and this time my luck improved. I moved into an atmosphere of gilded elegance. I became a model at Hattie Carnegie's internationally famous dress shop on East 49th Street. Overnight, I found myself in a world of rich society women, glamorous movie stars, and free-spending men about town. Hattie was born Henrietta Koningeiser, the daughter of a Viennese immigrant who settled in Manhattan's Lower East Side. When Hattie opened her first shop on 10th Street, she took the name Carnegie in tribute to one of America's greatest success stories. Her partner, Rosie Roth, whom I got to know very well, designed dresses, and Hattie made hats. Hattie combined unerring good taste and a shrewd business sense. Her shop was a fabulous success right from the start, and she and Rosie moved uptown, nearer the carriage trade. Just a few years before I first went to New York, Hattie bought a brownstone at 42 East 49th Street. Her salon was lavishly beautiful, with entire rooms of gold-leaf antiques from a French chateau. Hattie was a tiny dynamo, direct and outspoken. She wouldn't let anyone buy a dress she considered unbecoming. Gertrude Lawrence once spent $22,000 in a single afternoon in her shop. I'm told she would have spent more, but Hattie didn't approve of some of her choices. Hattie taught me how to slouch properly in a $1,000 hand-sewn sequin dress, and how to wear a $40,000 sable coat as casually as rabbit. Since I was her youngest and least experienced model, I was soon covered with bruises where she kicked me in the shins to remind me to bend my knees properly or pinched me in the ribs to make me raise my chest higher. Fiery, volatile Hattie fired me at least once a week, but like all the other models, I responded not to those outbursts, but to her great warmth, and loved her. Mostly, I modeled long, slinky evening gowns and suits, 30 to 40 changes a day. With each change, I had to slip into matching shoes, whether they were my size or not, and go wobbling out over the ultra-thick carpet. By nighttime, my feet were as swollen and sore as my shins. For this, I earned the princely sum of $35 a week. Good wages back in 1929. Connie and Joan Bennett were frequent customers, and I lost no time in bleaching my hair the color of Joan's and imitating her style, flat on top with dippy waves on each side. Joan Crawford, Gloria Swanson, and Ina Clare also came to Hattie's. I tried to analyze their styles, how they walked and moved their hands and eyes, what they wore, and how they talked. I also scrutinized the social register, full of Vanderbilts and Whitneys and Rhinelanders, to whom a price tag was just something a maid snipped off a dress. Barbara Hutton bought carloads of clothes, and at the Plaza and St. Regis and Pierre Hotels, where we appeared in all the important fashion shows, I learned to recognize all the leading debutantes. I didn't know it at the time, but I was storing up a lot of useful knowledge. An actress must draw upon her own background, what she has lived, seen, and observed. It's often been pointed out that Ginger Rogers and I can function on any level, high society, middle class, and street urchin. A superb comedian like Irene Dunne was only convincing in well-bred parts. Ginger could play a finishing school girl, a housewife, or Kitty Foyle. I can be as regal as a marquise, if the part calls for it, or peel a potato convincingly. By the time I worked for Hattie, I was no longer Diane Belmont, but Lucille Ball. I can't say that I enjoyed the life of a high-fashion model. I hated the stagnation that sets in when you are just a clothes horse. At Hattie's, I felt like a well-dressed dummy, but I did get out and see things and meet people for the first time in my life, and some pretty funny things could happen. I remember one time I wore a very tight-fitting Paris import to a horse show at Belmont. All of Long Island society was there, and we models were driven about in a Pierce Arrow touring car to show off our clothes. My dress was organza with a hand-painted fish scale design all over it. A sudden thunder shower drenched us, and the fish scales were applied to my skin, all over. I thought I'd be a mermaid permanently. As a Hattie Carnegie model, I began meeting some of the rich eligible bachelors in town, like Sailing Baruch Jr., Pat DiCicco, and Cubby Broccoli. Nightlife in New York then was a wonderful spree. You could dance until dawn in Harlem, watch the sun come up over Central Park, and breakfast in Greenwich Village. There were hundreds of supper shows and nightclubs and an endless number of big Broadway openings. I had the usual proposals, but at 18, marriage was the last thing on my mind. I feel sorry for young people today who feel so alone that they have to mate with their first crush. It shocks me that so many young brides are pregnant at the altar. When you have kids late in life, you appreciate them more. They keep you young, and you see the world through better eyes. You can give your children a finer sense of values, too, because if you're lucky, your own values have improved with time. But like today's teenagers, I got little sleep and seldom ate the kind of food my body needed. One winter day, I came down with a bad cold that turned into pneumonia. I stayed in my room restlessly for several days, tossing with fever, and then hurried back to Hattie's. I needed that $35 a week. I was standing on the dais for a fitting when suddenly I felt as if both my legs were on fire. The pain was excruciating. Hattie kindly sent me to her own doctor around the corner on Fifth Avenue. He told me that the pains were arthritic, possibly rheumatoid arthritis. This is an incurable disease which becomes progressively more crippling until the sufferer ends up in a wheelchair for life. You must go to a hospital at once, Hattie's doctor told me. I did some rapid calculations. I only have $85 to my name, I told him. He then gave me the address of an orthopedic clinic up near Columbia University. That night, I sat waiting my turn for 3 hours while the city's poor, some of them horribly crippled, went in and out. It was 10 o'clock before my turn came. The clinic doctor examined me and shook his head. I was, by this time, crying and half fainting from the pain. He asked me if he could try a new and radical treatment. Some kind of horse serum, and I said, yes, for God's sake, anything. For several weeks, I stayed in my room, and he came and gave me injections. Finally, when my money ran out and my legs still were not better, there was nothing left to do but go home to Jamestown. One of my beaus drove me to Grand Central Station and pushed me to the train in a wheelchair. I was discouraged, but not terribly frightened. The confidence of the young is truly remarkable. Johnny met my train at Buffalo and drove me to my family's apartment on Wilcox Avenue. Daddy was back home again, thank goodness. He lectured me on taking better care of myself, and Dee Dee, although still working all day long herself, devoted her evenings to massaging my legs and cheering me up. For the first few months, I was in such pain that time passed in a kind of blur. We kept up the horse serum injections, which were then considered a highly experimental, even last-ditch experiment. I was a guinea pig who survived, and the pain gradually subsided. Finally, the day came when, with the support of Daddy and the doctor, I shakily stood up. We found that my left leg was now somewhat shorter than my right leg. It also pulled sideways. And to correct this, I wore a 20-pound weight in one of my ugly black orthopedic shoes. The metal weight felt cold against my foot, and the pain as I clomped around was like needles. For my morale, I wore some heavy blue satin pajamas that I had bought on sale at Hattie's. Pajamas for women were just becoming fashionable. I think I was also the first female in Jamestown to appear on the street in slacks. One happy result of my long illness was that I did learn to take better care of myself. I tried to get my full 8 hours sleep a night, and I ate fewer starches and carbohydrates. I still go without the right food when I'm busy and often skip lunch or dinner altogether. This has the strange effect of making me gain weight, since my body retains fluid. Dr. Henry Beeler, whose patients include Greta Garbo and Gloria Swanson, wants me to eat small meals every few hours, and I'm trying to do this. He doesn't believe in pills or medicines, but he accomplishes wonders with food. It's shocking how many doctors in Beverly Hills never once ask during a consultation what you eat. In the late spring of 1930, I was still convalescing at home, my legs thin as matchsticks, when Bill Bemis came to see me. Bill had been a professional actor on Broadway, and so the Jamestown Players had asked him to produce and direct a fast-paced melodrama called Within the Law. Bill had seen me in various amateur productions around town since he'd first been impressed by my work in the Scottish Rite Review. He had a difficult part to cast in this new play, an ingenue who could convincingly play a cheap gangster's moll and also a debutante. Back in 1930, debutantes were considered models of good manners and breeding. Bill looked at me with my bright bleached hair, blue satin pajamas, and blood-red fingernails and burst out, "You are Aggie Lynch! Will you play the part?" "Who's Aggie Lynch?" I wanted to know. He then described to me the big scene of the play. Aggie is a hard-boiled confidence woman who blackmails married men. But when she's pinched and taken to the precinct station, she convinces the police inspector that he's made a bad mistake. She isn't the notorious Aggie at all, but the debutante daughter of the richest banker in town. The terribly cultured Aggie is highly insulted at being brought in like a common criminal. The inspector apologizes humbly, but just as she's about to sweep haughtily out, a cop enters and greets her casually. "Hello, Aggie." Her real identity uncovered. Aggie reverts to her real self. "So you think I'll squeal?" she sneers, coming back to the police inspector's desk. "Sure I'll squeal. Like hell." Well, that was pretty sensational in 1930. Hearing a young girl come out with that? Gasps of horror, twitters, snickers. We really got 'em. It was funny to think how tongue-tied and awkward I'd been in dramatic school. Here, in my beloved Jamestown, I didn't have a shred of self-consciousness. Bill Bemis told me I exuded personality. "You're better than the original Aggie on Broadway," he told me. "You can do tragedy, comedy, anything." Then the crowning glory. "You're a professional." The Jamestown Journal called me sensational, another Gene Eagles. Eagles, of course, played the prostitute in Somerset Maugham's Rain. We took the play to the Chautauqua Institute and gave another highly successful performance there. My friend Marion Strong couldn't get over how naturally I took to the stage. My poise was unshaken, even when a mouse ran across the stage in the middle of one of my big soliloquies. For the part of Aggie, I dyed my hair dark, and just before the performance, Marion tinted it with golden glint, which gave it a reddish cast. For the first time, I began to wonder if maybe I didn't have a red-headed personality. But Broadway seemed as far off as ever. In the summer of 1930, another tragedy befell our family. Aunt Lola had completed her nurse's training and was then head of a psychiatric ward in a mental hospital in Long Island. Apparently, she had been bothered by stomach pains for some time, which she foolishly ignored. One night, a patient kicked her in the stomach, and she died that night of peritonitis. Almost immediately, Uncle George Mondikos appeared and took Cleo away with him to Buffalo. My little cousin was only 11 when, overnight, she found herself in a motherless home with a father she hardly knew, in a Greek community where everything was strange to her, the food, the customs, the language. It just about broke her heart, and Dee Dee's too. The double loss of Lola and Cleo severely upset us all. A few weeks after Cleo left, the Pier Ballroom at Celeron Amusement Park burned up in a spectacular blaze on a Sunday morning. Marion Strong and I had been dancing there the night before with our dates. We wondered whose carelessly dropped cigarettes had started the fire. Marion and I stood by the lakeshore watching the towering flames devour the old ballroom. Steam billowed up from the cold lake as the burning timbers crashed down. The dense black smoke billowing into the summer sky could be seen for miles. This was where I'd gone to my first dance, in my pussy willow taffeta dress with its band of real fur. This was where my first bittersweet crushes were born and died to the strains of Margie and Swonderful. I began to cry. And then I couldn't stop. All the ghosts in those crackling flames shooting into the sky. My wonderful, happy childhood in Celeron gone forever. And so tragically. My first picnics in the park. What exciting occasions they were. With Florabelle in her Sunday best, the hamper full of goodies over her arm, and Grandfather Fred so good-looking with his jaunty air, his straw boater cocked over his smiling blue eyes, and Lola with her sunny waves honeymooning with George, and Cleo with her dimples. Marion was crying, too. And we clung together, drowning in a sea of tears. Marion says that she never cried so much again in her whole life. I wish I could say the same. 4. It was the following spring that I persuaded Marion to go with me to New York to look for work. We each had $20 in our handbags the day a friend drove us to the city. I knew enough freelance illustrators to earn $40 a week posing for coffee and cigarette ads. Marion found a job in a Greenwich Village antique shop. At the Hotel Kimberly at Broadway and 74th Street, we shared a room with twin beds and bath for $18 a week. We even shared one bureau. Marion had a lot of stubborn Swede in her. I tried to organize her life too much, she complained. I felt protective toward her, but when I gave her too much advice, she got mad. We had some lulus of fights. Once, I didn't approve of some guy she was seeing, and we argued half the night. The next morning, as I was hurrying to get ready for work, I remembered that it was Marion's 20th birthday. I ran out, bought some fresh spring daffodils, and jammed them into a water glass on the bureau. "Happy birthday, old scrap iron," I scrawled on a note while she slept. Marion, bless her, still treasures that note. Marion was timid about many things. I could never talk her into traveling underground on the subway. When we walked about New York, I ran at full tilt, dodging between people on the sidewalks. I seldom waited for a light to change, but was halfway across on the red while Marion quivered on the corner. She got homesick for Jamestown after a few months and went back home. In a couple of years, she was married and raising a family. I got a job modeling in a first-class clothing house owned by a wonderful couple named Jackson. Hattie Carnegie's mink-lined establishment made me uncomfortable, but the Jacksons was a fun place, full of warmth and laughter and a family feeling. The clothes were exquisite and expensive, but instead of bored socialites for customers, we had women department store buyers, full of talk and gossip and sharp as foxes. I clowned around a lot and made them laugh. That didn't hurt sales any. At that time, I lived in an east side flat directly over an Italian restaurant reeking of garlic. I gave the buyers a demonstration of how I went stamping and banging and singing up the stairs when I got home at night to chase the rats and cockroaches away. The designer was Rosie Roth, who had been Hattie Carnegie's partner at the start of her meteoric career. The Jacksons paid her $25,000 a year, an unheard-of salary for a woman designer then, and sent her to Paris several times a year. Rosie brought back truckloads of French silks and satins heavy enough to stand alone. Her creations were fitted individually to 7 models. Often I stood for 3 hours or so while she draped and tucked and pleated, her mouth full of pins. When I got bored, I'd camp. That's a show business word for getting playful. "This girl's full of hell," Rosie would complain, sticking me with a pin to make me behave. "You got flair. You got personality. A beautiful body you got," she told me. "So why so aggravating? You make my ulcer ache." Sometimes she'd yell, "You're fired." I'd run out of the place gleefully, knowing that a phone call that evening would rehire me. This was in the days before air conditioning, and dresses weren't lined. When the temperature stood at 100 in that stuffy little fitting room, the black fuzz from the long velvet gowns would stick to our bodies in the heat and stuff our pores. Phew! I can still feel it now. No matter. I was happy there because the Jacksons treated their models like their own daughters. When I had dinner dates with nice young men, Mrs. Jackson often let me borrow one of Rosie's glittering creations. Of course, I had to get it back early in the morning before Rosie arrived for work. She objected to the models parading her originals around town, getting cigarette burns and gravy stains on them, but the Jacksons were most generous and understanding. I was the bride who ended every fashion show. The tired dress buyers with their aching varicose veins would drop in just to see me whirl around in yards of white lace or organdy or satin. Some girls are perennial bridesmaids. I was the perennial bride. Platinum blonde and blue-eyed, full of naive girlish dreams. And, as Rosie was always telling me, full of hell. A movie scout saw me one night at a silk ball. He telephoned me the next day at work to suggest a movie test. This was the beginning of July, our busiest season, so I told him over the phone, "Well, thanks very much, but I couldn't possibly. All the buyers are in town, and we're showing our new line. My outfits are made just for me, and nobody else can model them." I hung up and dismissed the whole thing from my mind. But my boss, Mr. Jackson, had overheard the conversation. He made me phone back. "Paramount wants to test me every day this week," I told him. "Wonderful," replied Mr. Jackson. "That's more important than modeling a few clothes. Say you'll go." That big-hearted, wonderful man insisted that I take the tests. But they came to nothing. I still wasn't photogenic, it seemed. I continued working at the Jacksons, and during these depression years, Dee Dee separated from Ed. This upheaval, along with losing Cleo, gave her a bad time emotionally, so I suggested that she send Freddie to New York to live with me. He came and shared my dark little apartment over that Italian restaurant and went to high school in New York until Dee Dee's health improved. When she recovered her spirits, We all got an apartment together. Me, Dee Dee, Daddy, and Freddy. My mother found a job as a sales lady at Stearns on 42nd Street. At night, our bathroom looked like a Chinese laundry. Daddy even washed his own shirts. But at last, we were together. For Daddy, however, the move was a catastrophe. He was already in his late 60s, too old to find a job during the Depression. He had nothing to do but brood alone in the apartment or walk the city streets. The filth and misery of New York City slums was worse than anything he had ever seen or imagined. He began to worry about the world and everyone in it. To earn more money, I often posed at night and on weekends for commercial illustrators. A freelance painter named Ratterman did an oil portrait of me in a flowing chiffon dress, something I'd borrowed overnight from Rosie. Later, he added two gray Russian wolfhounds for a touch of class. To my great surprise, he sold the painting to Chesterfield Cigarettes, and overnight my face and figure were on billboards all over town. Russell Markert, director of the Rockettes at Radio City Music Hall, noticed the new Chesterfield girl high over Times Square and recognized me. He'd met me briefly back in my days with Hattie. Sylvia Hollow, a theatrical agent, noticed me too. She had had her eyes open for young models who might profitably be exported to Hollywood, and she knew my face and name from many fashion shows. The Jacksons' wholesale house was at 39th Street and 7th Avenue. Often, on my lunch hour, I'd walk the few blocks to Times Square and gaze wistfully at the photographs in the theater lobbies. One humid July day, I was browsing in front of the Palace Theater when I heard a woman's voice at my elbow. "Lucille Ball, just the person I was looking for. How would you like to go to Hollywood?" I turned and saw Sylvia Hollow.
What?
"You're the latest Chesterfield girl, aren't you?" Sylvia continued. "Well, Sam Goldwyn, the producer, needs a dozen well-known poster girls for a new Eddie Cantor movie, Roman Scandals. He had 12 all picked, but one just backed out, and they're scheduled to leave for Hollywood in 3 days, and..." "Who do I see?" I interrupted. "Where do I go?" Sylvia nodded over my shoulder. "Right up those stairs by the Palace Theater, second floor. Jim Mulvey. He's Mr. Goldwyn's New York agent."
"Thanks,"
I yelled over my shoulder in a dead run. "Don't forget my 10%, Sylvia called after me. This was on a Wednesday. Fortunately, there was no time for a screen test or I might never have been accepted. Jim Mulvey liked my enthusiasm and signed me on the spot. I had a guarantee of $125 a week for 6 weeks, plus free transportation. The Jacksons gave me a leave of absence with their blessings, even though it just about ruined their fall show. So, on Saturday, just 3 days after my fateful brush with Sylvia Hollow, Dee Dee and Daddy saw me off on the Super Chief for Hollywood. Everything happened so fast that I had no chance to realize that this was my first major break, a marvelous stroke of good luck. And, of course, I expected to be back in New York before the maple leaves flamed in Central Park. Dee Dee had a story she used to tell us about Hollywood when we were small that we loved hearing over and over. When she went out there following the death of my father, Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford were America's sweethearts. Dee Dee had the good fortune to be on the same train with Mr. Fairbanks. As it drew into Los Angeles, the acrobatic actor jumped from the train and vaulted a low barrier by the tracks into the arms of the golden Miss Pickford, who was waiting for him in a baby blue convertible. Here were all the ingredients of the Hollywood dream: sex, glamour, money, a handsome young couple adored by millions and adoring each other. In my wildest dreams, I never expected to get to Hollywood. Yet here I was, riding into the same station I'd heard Dee Dee describe so often, with a movie contract in my pocketbook, already creased with wrinkles from having been read so often. Hollywood, in 1933, was a busy, bustling place full of men about town and producers chasing would-be starlets around that famous piece of furniture, the casting couch. But not Lucy. I was one of the lucky few to arrive in movie land with a contract. I was already under a studio's protective wing. In those days, that was a blessed way to begin. There was a big hoopla when we arrived at the Pasadena station, with a crush of photographers, press agents, and studio people. I was wearing a black silk dress with a demure white collar, an outfit Constance Bennett made famous. The Hattie Carnegie dress was 5 years old, but I felt like a queen in it. We drove from Pasadena to Hollywood. Hollywood looked like a sleepy little village completely ringed by hills, a place of wondrous beauty after the dirt and grime of New York. I just sat back in my cushioned limousine seat and drank it all in. The olive and lemon and orange trees, the strange and exotic flowers, the chorus of birds, and over everything, the clearest, purest air. You felt you could reach out and touch a mountain 20 miles away. Nobody thought of smog in those days. Like TV, it didn't exist. We were taken to the Roosevelt Hotel for my first press interview, where I was dumb enough to tell reporters my right age. 21. We met Sam Goldwyn and other studio executives who asked us where we wanted to live. I decided on a one-room Murphy bed apartment on Formosa Street, about 3 blocks from the United Artists studio where Roman Scandals was to be filmed. Finally, it was time to report for work. I tried to learn from past experiences, and my miserable failure as a dramatic student still rankled. I vowed that I wasn't going to muff this unique opportunity by being tongue-tied and stiff and self-conscious. By this time, too, after my happy years at the Jacksons modeling, I liked myself better. The next morning at the studio, we were handed skimpy jersey bathing suits and told to line up. Chiefly, that's what we did for months, line up and wait. I weighed only 111 pounds, and the other girls were sort of voluptuous, so while we waited, I padded myself with gloves or paper or old banana peels, anything I could find just to make fun. When Eddie Cantor walked down the line to give each Goldwyn girl the once-over, I made a special effort. I remembered a trick I'd seen Dorothy Gish do at Belmont Racetrack. She and her sister Lillian were sitting in a box with two gentlemen when the Hattie Carnegie models were ushered into seats right behind them. After a while, Lillian went off with a gentleman. Dorothy was just sitting there, tearing off little pieces of paper from her bright red program. Then she turned around, and I saw that she had stuck them like measles spots all over her face. Well, I thought this was about the funniest thing I'd ever seen. So as Eddie Cantor started down the line, I tore up some little pieces of red crepe paper, wet them with my tongue, and stuck them all over my bare arms and chest and face. When Mr. Cantor got to me, his jaw dropped. His big eyes popped, and then he roared with laughter. He asked me my name. He told everyone about that ball dame. She's a riot. I was in heaven. Roman Scandals was one of United Artists' biggest musical extravaganzas of 1933. The Depression hit Hollywood hard at first, but since movie tickets cost only 50 cents, the movie industry suffered less than the Broadway theater. By 1933, people were happy to plunk down half a dollar to forget temporarily the grim breadlines and bank closings. In addition to Eddie Cantor, Roman Scandals had Ruth Etting, Gloria Stewart, Alan Mowbray, and Edward Arnold. Cantor was the emperor's food taster in the times of the Roman Empire. The fresh and funny script was written by George Kaufman and Robert Sherwood. The songs included the tuneful Keep Young and Beautiful and Build a Little Home. According to one reviewer, Roman Scandals was photographed lavishly and set with considerable taste. Eddie is surrounded by beautiful girls who seem in their languid splendor to have stepped out of a frame devised by the late Florence Ziegfeld. Languid may have been how we appeared. Exhaustion was the cause. They used very large sets with tremendous casts and many, many Klieg lights. And this was in July. The lights were terribly dangerous in those days and detrimental to your eyes. When the director yelled, "Okay, hit the lights!" everyone knew it was time to look down. If you looked directly at the lights, you got a piercing, knife-like pain in your head. So you looked at the floor until your eyes got adjusted. Even so, we Goldwyn girls all went to bed with raw potato poultices on our eyes. Those Klieg lights burned our eyeballs so. In one particular scene, we slave girls were high up in a rotunda, chained by our wrists, in the nude, supposedly, while the slave traders with long black whips walked around below, picking out the girls they wanted. We wore long hemp wigs, which came to our knees, with a few scraps of chiffon underneath. In those days, there were no definite working hours. We slaved all day, and sometimes until 3 in the morning. We'd come to the studio at 6 a.m., get body makeup on, and then get chained up in the rotunda. Shooting didn't always start right away, and they didn't get you down between shots because that was too much trouble. One particular time, they had left us up there several hours, and some of us weren't feeling too well. This had been going on for weeks. Suddenly, I fainted and fell. The fake chains holding my wrists gave way, and I started to fall toward those bare, burning Klieg lights below. There was a